Another hour of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, thrilled and delighted to be your host again today. Because you know, here at Advanced Living, we just have a focus of attention to enjoy ourselves and to bring real value to you. And this comes as through a daily meditation, daily prayer, daily intention, however you want to call it. It goes like this. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, show me the best ways to have the most fun inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so we can all get our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. Wow, I just love reading that, dwelling upon it, and sharing it with you. It's, of course, gigantic in scope, and yet every step we take in that direction is moving us to somewhere better. So, thank you for participating with me in this. As we get our show started today, I want to take a moment to invite you to check out the sponsor of our program, at advancedliving.com, actually advancedlivingcomfort.com for the holiday specials. When you go to advancedlivingcomfort.com, you're going to find the comfort technology. It's a plug-in device. It looks like a digital clock because it uses a clock as a housing. You plug it in, and it creates an energy shift that mitigates the stress of our high-tech electric world. And many of you know, oh my gosh, the computers, the cell phones, the Wi-Fi, just on and on, this electrical onslaught that is helpful for technology, but really hard on us. I mean, there's now countries in the world that have officially declared electromagnetic stress is an actual disease condition. It's so hard on people. So check out advancedlivingcomfort.com. And now, talking about some comfort, what would be more fun than us checking in about some wonderful, wonderful places in the world to visit and possibly to relocate? We have an incredible guest with us today who is in own right a bit of an explorer, spent time up in Alaska. Our guest today, Mark Krieger, is a professional investor and the founder and managing director of Krieger Capital Limited. Now, he is an ex-Alaskan who has fled the tyranny of the U.S. government. Yes, I know, he said it, and there's a lot of folks that agree with him, fled the tyranny of the U.S. government and is now living in New Zealand, has lived there since 2010, where he is now married to his beautiful Kiwi wife. And, of course, as you know, in in New Zealand, they're called kiwis. It's not, she didn't marry a fruit, okay, folks? I mean, you have to know this. And now, before founding Krieger Capital, Mark owned Alaskan Leopard Tours, and it was a seasonal tour company in Alaska. He also has worked as a financial advisor for a Fortune 500 company, big. And he graduated with honors from the University of Texas and won first prize at the Texas State Citizen Bee. Don't you love this? Not a spelling bee, Texas State Citizen Bee, during his senior year in high school. So he comes from a place of actually caring, and he has traveled extensively throughout the world, and his political, economic, and social commentaries have a sizable audience. He is a prodigious investor with active business ventures in several countries. Now, aside from investing, Mark enjoys hiking, sports, and reading about history, and he prefers the wonderful bubolic scenery, the serenity of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the city. So it's not a surprise he might have ended up in where? New Zealand. Well, welcome, Mark.
Welcome. Thank you for having me, Ken.
Ah, it's a great pleasure to have you. And I guess there's about, 4 hours difference? There's a day later, but 4 hours earlier. So you're in the middle of your Sunday afternoon.
That's right. It's 1 p.m. here on Sunday here in New Zealand.
Ah, and now I'm wondering, can you go into a little bit more detail about what made you decide to leave the United States?
Certainly, Ken. The factors that impelled me to leave the United States were many. The main one is that I view the United States as an empire that's in the midst of a severe decline, and I think in the coming years the situation in the United States is going to deteriorate significantly, and I felt that the prudent thing for me as a relatively young person was to pack up and leave and go somewhere else. If you look at, say, for example, the political situation in the United States, irrespective of which party you belong to, you can see that the country is becoming dysfunctional. I mean, if you look at the spending, you know, the government spends more on discretionary spending than it actually takes in tax revenue, and the country sort of living beyond its means, and in many respects, I think the country has sort of become ridden with the excesses of affluence, and it's just sort of on the way downhill. And fortunately, there are many other places in the world that are sort of on the up, where people have good economic opportunities, good opportunities to lead a life that's maybe a little bit closer to nature, and I decided to take the plunge and leave, and I'm very happy, and I'm here to share a little bit about my experience with your listeners and hopefully, you know, help them at least get some information so they can decide what's best for them.
Sure, absolutely. Now, you gave a little bit of information in terms of the spending. Can you share a little bit more from your research about why you believe the U.S. is on the precipice of a financial meltdown?
Certainly, Ken. I think there's obviously the factor of government spending. I mean, essentially, the society lives beyond its means, and at some point, that's no longer going to be sustainable. Many of you have seen, for example, in Greece, there's been a lot of political tension, and there's been widespread riots in the street because essentially the country can no longer borrow more because it's lived beyond its means. Now, at the moment, Greece is still held together because it's a small country, and the rest of the European Union has provided it with bailout funds. But America is on the same sort of inexorable path to destruction, but there's no entity in the world that's big enough to bail out America. And once the country can no longer borrow, and once the dollar stops being the reserve currency, then Americans are going to experience a significant erosion in living standards, and it's likely that there's going to be widespread mayhem in the country. And so I think for the average person, you know, you're sort of unable to change things, but you do have the opportunity to vote with your feet, and that's why I've emigrated and why I urge a lot of people at least to consider it and see if it's right for them.
Wow. Well, there's a friend that's a Britisher, may not have heard of him. His name is Stuart Wilde, and one of the things that he spoke about was some of the Jewish people living in Nazi Germany during the time of the rise of Hitler in the 30s. And a lot of folks, in the midst of all they could see, just stood still. And it was like the ostrich with the head in its sand. And he made mention that there were some others, in a way like you, that they began to see something. And they said, wait, this is not a good situation. And some families moved from Germany, this one family talks about, to Austria, and then things went bad as Hitler expanded into other countries, and they left Austria and went to London, and then pretty soon London was in jeopardy, and they left, came to the United States. And so I'm just sharing that because I'm really in support of what you're wanting to share with us, is You did your due diligence and came to a decision to leave, and now you're helping us to consider some things of interest that when we take a look, we might decide similar to you. So thank you.
Look, you're very welcome, Ken. I guess, you know, sort of based on my professional background, I often sort of focus on economic factors, but I think there are things that are a lot more important than economics and that never show up on the balance sheet. And one of the things that I find very alarming and disquieting about the U.S. is just the lack of political freedom and just the growth of the police state that's happened over the past 10 or 15 years. It doesn't really matter on which side of the political spectrum you're on in America. If you actively speak out against the government and you're not a part of the controlled oligarchy, then the government will sort of persecute you. You know, you have on the one hand, you have people, say, on the left, like the Occupy Wall Street people, and I see some of the images of police brutalizing essentially what I view as innocent people just expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. Conversely, say, the Tea Party, I think a lot of people want the spending in Washington to go down. They want to see the restoration of their personal liberties. And these guys as well have been ostracized. They've been criticized in the media. People have called them names like Nazis and so on. And obviously these two groups of individuals are on opposite sides of the political spectrum, but the point is that when they try to express themselves, the police state in America really hammers and silences them. And I think it's very important for people who do stay in America to at least look at options of diversifying yourself internationally. You know, look at maybe having a bank account overseas, or maybe having property somewhere else, because if things get very bad, at least everything is not within the control of the United States government. You have some opportunity or place that you can go. And I think it's very important that people are cognizant of that, because if not, if you don't prepare now when you still have a chance, if things do get significantly worse, then you're going to be in a situation where you can't look after yourself or look after your family.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned something previously, Mark, about from a financial standpoint, a lot of folks aren't thinking about the dollar as the international reserve currency. Can you explain that a little bit? Because you made mention that there's some very significant financial implications with this.
Certainly. The U.S. dollar essentially is the reserve currency of the world. It was set up that way at Bretton Woods in 1947. What that means on a practical level is that foreigners often have to transact business in dollars. Let's just say, for example, with oil. The oil market is denominated in U.S. dollars, so if the sheikhs in the Middle East have to sell oil to, let's just say, Germany or Japan, they essentially have to, the Japanese or the German buyers have to buy U.S. dollars. They use those U.S. dollars. They'll pay the sheikhs in the Middle East, and then from there they'll convert the money to their own currency. What that does on a practical level is that it allows the United States to print a lot more dollars than it otherwise would, and in many cases that allows America to export inflation around the world. Let's look at the most classic example, which is China. China artificially depresses its currency to help its export sector. Now, what that does is it allows Americans to buy trinkets and things at Walmart, probably for a lot less than they otherwise would. But what happens is, for China to keep that peg, it has to print an equal number of yuan, essentially. So it brings inflation into its own country, essentially to keep its export sector happy and humming along. Now, what that does, obviously, it hurts people in China in the sense that the government's foremost concern in China is to keep the population under control and to keep them working. So long as people are working, they're not actually going to try to overthrow the system. So what ends up happening, though, is that people end up paying a lot more for goods and services through inflation. Now, what's going to happen is a lot of countries around the world are seeing this for what it is. It allows America artificially to live beyond its means. So some countries, for example, China and Russia, have signed a bilateral agreement where they've agreed that any trade that they do between them or between their own companies, they're going to do in their own currencies. You've seen some steps in Europe towards the formation of the EU. Now, it has its own sort of issues with the euro at the moment, but you're seeing a shift where a lot of countries want to move away from the U.S. dollar. The day that the U.S. dollar ceases to be the world's reserve currency is the day where, if Ben Bernanke continues to print money as he's doing, that money is going to produce significant inflation in the United States, and that's ultimately going to hurt people, because if you have a job and suddenly gas costs you 3 or 4 times more than it did the previous year, then you're suddenly not going to have a lot of money to spend, and consequently your living standards are going to drop. So that's something that I foresee happening at some point in the future as the world moves away from the U.S. dollar. It may not necessarily be imminent, but it is inevitable, and Americans should really prepare themselves for this.
Ah, all right. So this is one of those, I guess you'd call it the something coming at you, and it's not a happy thing, and you're indicating it's probably not going to take place within the next 6 months or a year, but just based on the way things are going, it's going to happen, and so the sooner that we start to take that into consideration, the better.
Absolutely, and I think people can do practical things such as opening an account overseas in foreign currency, so if the dollar does go down, they still preserve the purchasing power of their assets. They can own gold and silver and other precious metals. There are things that people can do to help themselves. I don't want to be sort of an alarmist who says that the world is going to go to hell. I want to give people at least some information and practical actions that they can take to protect themselves and their families.
Yeah, well, Mark, I really appreciate that very much, because to me it's so important if you watch the History Channel and some of the predictions of ancient times and of 2012 and the apocalypse, end of the world. I mean, this stuff is out there in a certain number of people's consciousness. A lot of the Christian community is excited for a big calamity in Israel and the Middle East to usher in the return of Jesus the Christ to lift all of those good folks up, and so there's these factors at play. And what I love about you and your work is that you're making mention, well, yes, there's some places that it's not in good shape and it's going to get worse. You talked about Greece and riots in the street, and then you make mention, well, if economic conditions get bad enough in the U.S., which it looks like they probably will, be prepared for some nasty stuff here. And then at the same time, you're going, well, wait a minute, there's other parts of the world that are doing just fine. And so you ended up in New Zealand. Maybe you can go into that as you talk about, especially your book, How to Escape America Guide.
Certainly can. As far as where I view New Zealand and Australia as being in a good position, there are several reasons. The first of which is both countries are run much more competently than the United States. For example, in terms of budget deficits, both countries have the least amount of debt of any of the major industrialized countries. Australia has a debt to GDP ratio of about 20%. New Zealand has a debt to GDP ratio of about 30%. Now, next year, Australia is supposed to have a budget surplus again, and New Zealand will have one in 2 years' time. So even though there's been the global financial crisis and both countries have run temporary deficits, they're in a position where they're going to be running surpluses going forward, just as they were running surpluses in the 2000s. The second is that there's a big shift that's happening economically from west to east. In many ways, the United States and Europe, through mismanagement, I guess through the atrophying of the civilization, you know, perhaps even through material decadence, you know, are in severe decline, whereas you see the countries in the East, like China, Korea, etc., are growing very rapidly. Now, New Zealand and Australia are in the Asia-Pacific sector, and they export very heavily to the growing economies of Asia. For example, Australia has a booming mining industry that's supplying China with the minerals that it needs to build up its country. Similarly, New Zealand, for a small country, exports probably around 90-95% of its food abroad. And you're having in Asia, you're having hundreds of millions of people who are eating sort of better foods and foods that require more to produce. And New Zealand and Australia are supplying these areas. So I think longer term, the trajectory is a lot better in these parts of the world. And I also focus on them for Americans because they're English-speaking countries. And from a practical standpoint, although people can move to other countries and learn other languages, everybody does it, I think a lot of Americans, probably culturally speaking, would feel a little bit more attuned to, you know, New Zealanders and Australians compared to people, say, in other parts of the world. And that's one of the reasons why you know, I've written this book, and I'm just sort of guiding Americans and sort of do consultations for people to get them overseas if they think that that's what's right for them.
Sure. Now, you have a website that you could share so people could learn more about your work, Mark?
Certainly. They can visit kriegercapital.biz. It's K-R-I-E-G-E-R. Or they can just Google my name, Mark Krieger, and How to Escape America Guide, and they'll find me. There's a lot of general information that's very good. And we do sort of financial and immigration consultations that offer sort of very good value because they explain the nuances of how you get a work permit and how you can sort of move to these countries. And it's a lot easier than many people think. I mean, for instance, if you're under 30 and you're a U.S. citizen and you have a U.S. passport, you can come to either New Zealand or Australia for 1 year on a work permit, and you can use that towards getting a job that allows you to get permanent residence. So it's not to say that it's not without its challenges, but if you have the right information and the right mindset, you know, you can do anything. It's, you know, you can do anything that you put your mind towards.
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay. Well, now, can you, you're beginning to share a bit about this, can you go into a little bit more detail? So you said if you're under 30, and you have a passport, it's pretty easy. Are there some other things that you can go into about the prospects for people at different age groups to get over there?
Absolutely. There's opportunities, I guess, for people across the age spectrum. It's generally easier if you're younger and if you have the right skill set, but anybody you know, who's sort of entrepreneurially minded and who really sets out to move to another country can do it. Let's just say, for example, if you're older and you're just looking to retire, both countries have retirement visas that allow you to move down there and live, and they have sort of specific stipulations, and I won't sort of bore you with the details. But if you're just sort of, you know, in the latter stages of your life and you're looking at, you know, going somewhere else and maybe living in places that have more political stability, you can definitely do it. Similarly, sort of if you're in the mid stages of life, say maybe 30 to 50, and you're wanting to go somewhere else, generally speaking, you need to have some kind of useful occupation that's sort of on the skill shortages list for both countries. Now, it doesn't necessarily require you to be a neurosurgeon. There are professions, sometimes such as plumbers, engineers, various other occupations that are on the skill shortages list. So if you can essentially get yourself a job in either one of those countries, you can get yourself sort of enough points to qualify for a residence visa, and that lets you move to either country. And then once you've lived there for 5 years and you've had a residence visa, you can become a citizen. And then there are other options where maybe if you don't fit these particular criteria, you can come down on a work permit and try to get yourself some kind of a permanent job so that you can stay. It's a little bit different, I suppose, from U.S. immigration in the sense that New Zealand and Australia try to use immigration as a way of bringing in talent from other countries. So it's not necessarily a question of sort of hopping and taking a flight and just landing there. If you do that, you're obviously, and you overstay your visa, you're there illegally, and it's probably a lot more difficult to carry on illegally in either of the two countries than it would be in the U.S. But if you go in with a plan and you sort of look at what your skills are and what job experience you've had and what sort of things you're capable of doing, you can definitely leverage those things towards getting a residence visa. And that's one of the things that I discuss in my book. And it's something that when we do consultations, we will look at your resumes and give you sort of some indication of different things that you can do. So it does vary as far as how difficult it is, but it's definitely doable if you have the right mindset and I suppose, the right skill set in many cases.
Ah, okay. And then these things are set out on the website, the KriegerCapital.biz, for people to look at. And then someone can, make an appointment with you for a consultation and then discuss their particular situation?
That's right. I mean, one of the things we do is we'll sit down sort of with an hour appointment either by phone or through Skype, and, you'll send us your resume and we'll look at, what sort of skills you have, what you want to do, and then we try to match it up with the right type of visas or the right route that might allow you to, to move to both countries. It is a fairly competitive process. New Zealand and Australia combined allow about 160,000 people per year to migrate, but if you go in with a plan, you can definitely do it, and that's one of the things that that I try to help out. One of the things that you'll learn in this process is that there are sort of unscrupulous people who make all sorts of promises and take thousands of dollars and then don't actually deliver what they're set out to do. So we offer a bit of an overview of how the process should work so that people can eventually sort of do it yourself, because I think most people, barring some very extreme cases, can apply to immigrate to New Zealand and Australia and do it themselves without necessarily spending thousands of dollars on an immigration lawyer or a migration agent.
Wow. I was impressed when I took a look, and I certainly recommend folks get his How to Escape America guide, because in there you made mention of that there's some things that you share freely about some basic things a person can go on the internet and do, I guess, on a New Zealand or a Australian website, that some of these folks you've been talking about, some of the consultants, would charge someone $1,000 for what takes 10 minutes. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, essentially, if you apply for what I call the working holiday permit, and I explain it in my book, you can do that essentially for free. Australia has a fee that you have to pay of about 280 Australian dollars, but you actually have some consultants that will charge you, upwards of $1,000 for something that you can do yourself in, 15 minutes on a website. It's just a question of knowing the information. Similarly, I've seen cases of people who, the migration people promise them, the moon, and they take thousands of dollars from them and ultimately never deliver. So part of what I try to offer is essentially, I'm not a migration agent. I essentially just do consultations on an hourly basis, and they're very, very well priced. We only charge $39 for the consultation. Is basically give you the right sort of information so that people don't take advantage of you, and ultimately where you can save yourself thousands of dollars in the process. It is an expensive ordeal to move to the other side of the world. You'll have to sell stuff. You'll have to move to another country, but it is quite doable, and there's no reason why you should have to overpay to do it. And that's kind of what where I try to help people out.
One of the things I'm just kind of chuckling a little bit as I was looking through your book, was this description of the difference between what it's like as we go through an airport here in the United States and what you encountered when you showed up in New Zealand. Would you share a little bit about that?
Look, absolutely. I mean, in the United States, I think everyone who has flown recently knows what a ridiculous ordeal it's become. When you come down here, if you land at the airport, you're greeted sort of by very friendly customs officials, and you go through, and it's a non-issue essentially. You don't have these what I call sort of porno scanners, where essentially in the United States you have to go through these full body scanners where they take sort of nude images of you, and somebody, a few feet away sort of views it. Those things are sort of incredibly intrusive. They don't do anything to enhance safety and so on. There's no such thing like that down here. And I think it makes a big difference. I think another thing that I really like about living in New Zealand specifically is just in terms of, for example, access to good quality foods. In the United States, if you drink sort of milk from a regular grocery store, the milk sort of tastes very watered. Down here, the farmers aren't allowed to give the cows a lot of the same hormones that they receive in the United States. So you drink milk, and whilst it's not the milk that you would get straight out of the cow, it's sort of much better quality, and the same with the fruits and vegetables. New Zealand produces almost all of its food itself, and has quite a variety of fruits and vegetables, and you can actually get things that are, just much better in quality and sort of free of some of these ridiculous and ultimately, I guess, very dangerous chemicals. And I think those are sort of things that, the economy is definitely better down here. But I think in terms of those things, you have to look at it as a person. You have to say, do you want to live in a place where the almighty dollar is the most important thing, or where you can actually maybe get access to, better fruits and vegetables and just quality of food?
Yeah. Now, what's so interesting, from years and years ago, a company, Carnation, with their evaporated milk, they had a slogan that was so heartwarming. It said, our milk comes from contented cows. And of course, I don't really know back then, but the dairy industry in our country, and you'd made mention the hormones and a lot of people, like when I grew up, I didn't realize, because we would love to go out for a steak dinner when we celebrated, and it would list on the menu that it was corn-fed beef that they were serving, like it was a special feature that you could get corn-fed beef. And I'm not sure how things are there, but in my research, I've come to discover that corn is not really good for cows, and that makes them sick when that's their exclusive diet, and then they have to give them antibiotics and then the growth hormones to get them fatter quicker. And then if it's dairy cows and they're not really given a place where they can actually enjoy their life, if you ask a hunter, if an animal they shoot is not taken clean with one shot, that animal is wounded, the meat is basically ruined because the animal releases all these hormones. And a cow, or any of us, when we're under stress, we're releasing chemicals, and that would get into the meat, into the milk. So these are some important things you're bringing up.
Certainly, Ken. I mean, I'll give you an example in terms of dairy farming in New Zealand. I'm fairly knowledgeable about it because my wife grew up on a family dairy farm here in New Zealand. the cows in New Zealand are pasture fed, as opposed to getting fed, grain and various other things. And I can't speak for the meat because I'm a vegetarian, but at least in terms of the quality of the milk, it's significantly better. And you look at the pastures in New Zealand, and they're very sort of green and lush and so on. And you just sort of get, sort of happier. You get much happier animals, and that makes a big difference. I suppose in the sense of the meat, people who do eat meat, a lot of them will say, if you raise a cow, say, in Argentina as opposed to the United States or in New Zealand, depending on the type of local grasses, you'll get a slight difference in the taste of the meat. And I think in terms of some of the stuff that happens with food in the United States, people in Europe and people in New Zealand will, they view it as absolutely atrocious. I mean, it's just ridiculous the amounts of hormones and preservatives and things that people routinely ingest, because those things are in the food in the United States, and it's really, really unhealthy for you. And I'm not, I have a good friend of mine who I jokingly call him an organic snob, because he won't eat anything that's not organic and so on. I'm not like that, but I definitely think that, that you are what you eat, and if you eat these things that are just filled with chemicals and preservatives, it's ultimately going to hurt your health. And you just see it with so many people in the U.S. who have who suffer from a wide assortment of preventable diseases just because of poor nutrition.
Yeah. In my research, when I lived in San Diego, there are places, the Optimum Health Institute, different places in different parts of the country. Maybe, I don't know if they do it in New Zealand or not, you can tell me, but these places, people will eat raw and living foods, stuff that is sprouting, stuff that isn't cooked, and then they consume that, clear their colon with some enemas, and by golly, people with serious cancers, when they eat this way, their body gets so healthy that it gets rid of the cancer and all that kind of stuff. So when you're mentioning the quality of food is huge, I'm just so happy to see that, New Zealand that you've ended up in is much more conscious about this.
Definitely, and I think just in terms of having access to water and generally being a green place, I think we have an environment that we have to look after, and generally speaking, I think New Zealanders are very conscientious about the environment and trying to keep our waterways clean and just sort of growing good food. I mean, I had one of my clients from the United States who's looking at moving down here. He's been here before on a trip, and he says, I can get at the grocery store the stuff that I have to go to Trader Joe's to get because I can't get it at a regular grocery store, just on the shelves. And that makes a big difference. I mean, the stuff that you get at the regular grocery stores in New Zealand is probably of the same quality as the stuff that you would get in maybe some of the specialty shops back in the United States.
Yeah. And to me, I guess you can speak about this, but when I've looked at the idea of the body and nutrition, and if someone is eating well and they're well and their body is functioning better mentally, emotionally, they tend to be in better moods, tend to be more emotionally stable. And we're dealing in the United States with a lot of people that are way undernourished, that are on pharmaceuticals, and look at the upset, the violence, some of the craziness that's going on. And I mean, how much craziness you got going on there in New Zealand?
Look, I would say compared to the United States, it's very minimal. The crime rates here are very, very low. Violent crime is practically non-existent. And I think there are a variety of factors, including people's nutrition. Generally speaking, the other day, it was Black Friday yesterday in the United States, and we saw a couple of quick news stories about some of these throngs and mobs and so on who are, beating each other up to get, some gizmo at a reduced price. And my wife was absolutely horrified. I mean, she said, nothing like this would ever happen in New Zealand. And she was actually quite startled, and she said, well, is that common? And I said, well, obviously on the news they'll tend to show the outliers. They won't show the stores where people shop and nothing interesting happens. But it does say a lot about the consciousness of certain segments of society where that's the sort of thing that induces people to spend hours camping and then, you know, basically, you know, beating people up to get through a store. And I think what's actually really disconcerting about it is you think, you know, we sit down on Thanksgiving, and my wife and I celebrate it here. You sit down on Thanksgiving to give thanks to God for the blessings that he's given us, you know, during the preceding year, and to sit down with family and partake in fellowship. And then just a few hours after you sort of sat down and taken time to reflect, suddenly everybody's rushing and beating each other up just to get into a store to buy things. And I can't really connect that. I mean, it just, to me, it just seems very disturbing that that's what happens in with many people. Not everybody, but definitely more people than we care to admit.
Right, right. And to me, That's the worst of it, acting out. But when I looked at a video documentary called The Corporation and look at America as a state that is a big country where this corporate philosophy of profit at any cost, and as long as you don't get caught, it's okay, kind of a thing. And then when that's running the corporations, when that's running some of the government, to me, not a surprise that that ends up showing up in some of the attitudes of the population. So, anyway, I don't know how that relates to what you see in terms of the situation in New Zealand, Australia, as a contrast.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, in terms of corporate control, I guess, you know, the big companies exert influence regardless of where they're at on the globe. But I think in the United States, it's a lot more pervasive. In New Zealand, for example, because the disconnect between the rulers and the ruled is so much smaller, you actually do get a government that's accountable. Now, in New Zealand, you know, you do have some of the presence of some of these corporations, but you still have a significant number of people who engage in sort of small businesses that are outside sort of the corporate mainstream. I guess similarly in terms of the government in New Zealand, because the country only has about 4.4 million people, you don't necessarily have the corporate oligarchy that you have in the United States, where you have a revolving door. Say with the big banks, you have the treasury secretaries or ex-Goldman Sachs people, and they essentially sort of rule on behalf of the connected corporations. I mean, just to give you an example of how the government works here compared to the United States, when my wife and I fill out our personal taxes, we go onto the IRD website, which is the sort of equivalent entity to the IRS, and it takes about 10 minutes to do your taxes. And last year we had a sort of a negligible refund because they take basically what they're entitled to as they go along. And that's it. That's the process of applying for, you know, doing your taxes in New Zealand. Or if I, when I opened my company in New Zealand, I never had to go into a government office. I just went to a website. I registered my business. I signed and sent something in by fax. And within a day, I was in business. They organized, you know, the registration with a couple of different government departments. I didn't have to go into half a dozen different locations. Or even when my wife got her passport, she paid the regular service for the passport, and she turned it in on Monday, and by Thursday her new passport was in the mail, and we hadn't paid for expedited service. So in terms of how the government operates, you have a lot more competence here than you do in America. And, you know, to give you an example, that's probably why Transparency International ranks New Zealand as the cleanest country in the world in terms of having sort of the lowest incidence of perceived corruption, whereas the United States, unfortunately, has become an increasing corrupt place. And what's really bad is, you know, although I focus on economic things in a lot of my writings, is ultimately for there to be prosperity, you have to have virtuous people. And I'm not necessarily saying that only people of certain religions or certain type of people are virtuous. But as soon as a country becomes less virtuous, you end up having a country that becomes much more tyrannical and where the government assumes a lot more power. And unfortunately, that's what's happened in the United States. I think people have lost absence of those sorts of values that ultimately, you know, create wealth and ultimately sort of create a prosperous and harmonious society. And I think that in my own case, I thought that the most sensible thing was to go to other places in the world where I thought that perhaps the decline or the rot wasn't as severe as in the United States.
Ah, wow. To me, that's really important. And on a bit of, to me, what I could call bright news, I think you make mention that people in Australia can earn $200,000 a year without a degree.
That's right. I mean, for people who are working in the mining sector, in remote places in Australia, there are people sort of, you know, skilled blue-collar people who earn, you know, six figures and up to $200,000 working in the mines. I've got a link to a Bloomberg article about a guy who's 24 years old working in the mines in Western Australia, earning, you know, more money than Ben Bernanke. Generally, the salaries are much better down here than they are in the U.S. To give you an example, I mean, minimum wage in the U.S., I believe at the moment is $7.75, although it's a bit higher in some other states. In Australia, it's $15.91 Australian, and an Australian dollar is worth more than a U.S. dollar. So essentially, the minimum wage there is $16 per hour, and wages are probably maybe 50-60% higher than they are in the United States. The living costs are a little bit higher as well, and the same in New Zealand. Our wages aren't quite as high as Australia's, but they're higher than in the U.S. And I think people don't realize that in the United States over the past 30, 40 years, you know, the average person has never received a pay rise, whereas in this part of the world, you know, wages are growing and people's living standards are improving. In the United States, the only people that have received a wage increase have been the top 1%. You know,
yeah.
Your average family in the United States has about UBS, the Swiss bank UBS, commissioned a study, and they concluded that the median sort of net wealth per household in the United States was $53,000. So essentially half the households in the United States have less than $53,000 of accumulated assets and wealth. I mean, that's absolutely shocking. I don't know how people in America regard it as the absolute sort of paragon of civilization, where you have a country where there's such vast disparity between the top 1% or so and significant segments of society. And I'm not saying that everybody should be equal or anything like that, but clearly what's happened is the insiders have used the government to enrich themselves. And in the meantime, you know, the average American has really, you know, been financially disadvantaged because of that.
Yeah. You may or may not have heard of or seen a movie called Thrive.
I haven't, Ken. I'm not familiar with it.
There's a website called ThriveMovement.com, and a fella that's a descendant of the Gamble, Procter & Gamble family, major corporation, Foster Gamble, and his wife, Kimberly, spent many millions of dollars and a lot of years putting together a movie with some very interesting things in it. One aspect that they describe was the result of bringing central banking to the United States in 1913 through Woodrow Wilson's administration. And they, from their statistics, they said if the dollar was worth $1 in 1913 when the Federal Reserve took over, 100 years later, that same dollar is now worth 4 cents in purchasing power.
That's right, Ken. I mean, essentially what's happened with central banking is you have the what's called sort of the fractional reserve lending, in the sense that the central banks create money out of thin air and they give it to the to the retail banks, and they have sort of the first access to the money before it's actually before it's decline in purchasing power has sort of percolated to the rest of the population. They take that money and then they loan it at interest to businesses and consumers and so on. And ultimately, it's a racket that enriches the people at the top. Unfortunately, what's happened is ever since the end of the gold standard, central banks have created money out of thin air, and there's no constraint. When you have a gold standard, well, gold sort of places a ceiling on how much money you can actually print, because, you know, the amount of gold can only expand at about maybe 1% annually. It's difficult to mine, and it's an actual sort of tangible asset.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, I guess, in terms of central bank policy, you know, we do have central banks in New Zealand and Australia, just like any other country does, but the central banks are a lot more responsible. There's an interview on my website between me and the former Reserve Bank governor of New Zealand, and I would say, generally speaking, the Reserve Bank's primary function in New Zealand is to ensure price stability. Now, central banks are sort of inherently flawed models. But if you look at, say, the decline in the currency, you know, a New Zealand dollar was worth about 40 U.S. cents 10 years ago. It's now hovering at about 82, 83 cents. An Australian dollar was about 60 cents 10 years ago, and now it's at about $1.04, $1.05. And if you look at, say, how much the U.S. dollar has declined against gold in the past 10 years, the price of gold has gone from being under $300 an ounce to about $1,750. It has gone up in terms of the gold price in Australian dollars and New Zealand dollars, but it's only been about half as much because, generally speaking, the currencies or the central banks here probably act a little bit more responsibly. But I do agree with you wholeheartedly that the central bank model is ultimately ruining the world, and it's enriching the insiders, and it's ultimately, I guess, figuratively and literally impoverishing, you know, regular people.
Yeah, just so interesting that you've left the United States and found a place that in many ways is far superior. Now, I'm wondering about people may not want to move there, and you're a financial advisor, you're an investor. Can people make investments in these countries or open bank accounts and still not have to move there? How does that work?
Absolutely. I do offer a number of services. One is sort of where we sit down on a consultation basis and maybe recommend assets that you can buy down here. You can get, for example, the New Zealand stock market has gone up 24% in the past year, which is one of the best performing stock markets in the world. But there are a lot of good companies in New Zealand that where you actually get paid good dividends, where you're getting, you know, a good 6, 7, 8% dividend. One of the things that's happened in the stock market is that in many respects it's become a casino where, in America especially, the computers are trading, and there's actually a real disconnect between what the share prices are and what the companies are actually worth. Down here you can invest in sort of relatively stable companies like utilities and consumables and so on, get good good dividends, and protect yourself against a declining U.S. dollar. I also offer a service where I open bank accounts for people based in the United States, and essentially I don't handle the money myself, which is sort of work as a broker, essentially. But you can open up a bank account in New Zealand and Australia, get paid 5.5% interest on a 5-year term deposit. And the best part about it is it's a completely private account. So if you open an account in New Zealand, it's similar to what the Swiss banks used to offer you before the European Union and the United States have really tried to clamp down on Switzerland, where you essentially have a private account. It's denominated in New Zealand dollars, and you can protect yourself against the declining U.S. dollar. And perhaps more importantly, you have an asset abroad. So if the, let's just say in the United States with what's happening, if your neighbor accuses you of cheating on your taxes, the IRS decides to investigate it, and without any due process whatsoever, they've placed a lien on your house so you can't sell it. They've frozen your bank accounts. And not only that, but your neighbor is going to get a cut out of anything that the IRS recovers. And one of the things that's really alarming is that in the United States, everybody's a criminal because there are so many laws that nobody can actually live without breaking a law. It's what I call the criminalization of existence. If you have a bank account in a safe country like New Zealand, you can essentially, let's just say if this were to happen to you, you have an actual asset where you can get out of the country or at least, you know, fight back, where you have money that the U.S. government can't touch. And I'm not saying do this for tax evasion reasons. I'm just saying that this is a form of an insurance policy against a U.S. dollar devaluation or against the U.S. government embarking on a very draconian plan where they, you know, confiscate bank accounts. Or as we've been hearing recently, there are some rumors of the U.S. government wanting to force people in their IRAs to have to buy U.S. government debt. This is something that's already happening now, and I think people really do need to diversify and try to protect themselves from some of these policies.
Ah, okay. Oh, huge. Wow. Oh, I feel like we're just getting started, and we've blazed through most of our time here. Mark, I just want to ask you, give your website again so people can find out how to look into what you offer in your book and other things.
Certainly. My website is kriegercapital.biz. That's KRIEGER, capital CAPITAL dot BIZ. And you can just Google me, Mark Krieger, and How to Escape America Guide, and it should get you to my website. And if you have any questions, you know, just feel free to contact us through our website, and either I or somebody else will answer and hopefully help you and give you the right sort of information that can protect you and your family and maybe give you an opportunity in another country.
I appreciate that, Mark. It's a fabulous resource you're doing, and I certainly want to encourage people to look into your book and check out your services. And then I will be staying in touch and perhaps have you as a guest on, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months from now, and we see how things are playing out.
Certainly, Ken. Look, it's a profound honor to have you on your show, and I hope that your listeners found me informative and maybe a little bit entertaining, and can actually sort of act on some of this information.
There you go. That's the goal. Thank you, Mark. And to you, Mark, to my beloved listeners, God bless, and goodbye for now. Let go and let God cut myself.